Hi everyone, it's Fox here from Grapple Arcade, bringing you another episode of Turnchuckle on bbgwrestling.com. Today we're joined by a very special guest in the form of ECW music legend, Mr. Harry Slash. Harry, how are you doing, buddy?
Hey, how are you? Pleasure to be on.
Thanks for joining us, mate. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. This is my first podcast.
Yes.
Ironically, it had to be two gentlemen from London, from England, to invite me on a podcast. Meanwhile, there's 500,000 of them going on here in the States, and people seem to have forgotten about me, but that's okay.
Well, we'll go straight into it. As we chatted about beforehand, we're going to do a bit of a timeline about Harry Slash, about Slash Tones, but about you in general as a musician, how you got into music, and about where we end up today and everything in between, which is a little bit hardcore in places, I'm sure you'll agree. So to start off with, Harry, when did you get into music? When did you become Harry Slash, so to speak? What was your first instrument? Tell us all about it.
Okay, we have to go back a little bit. I realized I wanted to make music when I accidentally bought a copy of Led Zeppelin 1.
Wow.
I thought it was a transcript of the Hindenburg. I was very young. We're talking maybe 5-6 years old. And I was fascinated by the Hindenburg footage. And I had birthday money, and I had gone with my older cousins to a record store. I guess they wanted to pick up Beatles or something else. And they expected me to go buy Sesame Street or the Partridge Family or something kid friendly. And I saw the cover of Led Zeppelin 1. I never bothered to flip over, flip the album over. I'm like, this is what I want to buy. And I went home and I put Led Zeppelin 1 on a little plastic turntable, expecting to hear, an audio transcription of, the humanity, that the Hindenburg. And instead I heard Good Times, Bad Times, and Dazed and Confused. And I'm like, this isn't what I was expecting, but I like this. And from that point on, I wanted to have something to do with music. My first instrument was drums, and I wasn't coordinated enough to use two hands and two feet at the same time, so I abandoned that, and I got a guitar and started taking lessons, and, one thing after another. There was little garage bands, there were bands with other local musicians still taking music lessons, and it sort of developed from that.
Can you remember at all? Because most people remember their first guitar. Can you remember what your first guitar was, Harry?
It was a generic acoustic that was sold to me by the school that was going to be giving me music lessons.
Right. Okay. I get it. It's one of those things. It's a special thing in a young person's life, getting hold of that first guitar.
They'll have it, but it doesn't have any name or any brand on it. It's a generic nylon string acoustic that I still have in relatively decent shape. I just haven't played it in decades. My first electric guitar was a 1969 Gibson SG that I bought used, and then I bought a Les Paul, and I became a Gibson guy for a number of years.
Ah, right, okay, a bit of a Gibson header, yeah. I think my first was an Encore, just a very sort of cheap budget introduction electric guitar, because my parents at the time thought, right, he's maybe gone through a phase. We'll see how that goes. And my mum first got me into rock when she she bought me for my seventh. No, what? How old was I? I can't even remember how old I was now. I was pre-teenager, but she bought me a copy of Appetite for Destruction.
Oh, nice! I thought,
what a cool mum. So that was my first kind of taste of proper rock, if you like. And then the following year I saved up some money, and they put some money towards it, and I got hold of an Encore electric guitar. That was my first guitar, and that must have been early 90s, very early 90s at least. I've still got it, so I always ask any musicians that we get on the show what their first guitar was, so thanks for remembering. You're a bit of a Gibson head.
Prior to Zeppelin 1, I need to backtrack again. Before I was born, my father, his job was servicing the jukeboxes, where he would go to about two or three dozen different locations, bars and restaurants, and remove the old 45s. Yes, we are talking vinyl. And like most of the people that did his job would throw the 45s away when they replaced them with the new one. But my father, being a bit of a hoarder, kept all of them. So from a very young age, I had hundreds and hundreds of singles from the 50s and 60s that I had access to. I had a little plastic one-piece record player where the top opened up and that was the speaker. It was the typical starter turntable for every young kid born in the 60s. And I would go into the garage and I'd grab a stack of everything from Jimmy Day to Louis Armstrong to Frank Sinatra to early Jimi Hendrix to early Beatles and Kinks, and just play different songs on the little turntable. And that access basically broadened my horizons, where it wasn't just rock or pop that I was interested in. From an early age, I was into jazz and blues and a lot of international music, a lot of Celtic music, Greek music, you know, what have you. A plethora of music was at my disposal, which I think was very beneficial to me when I actually started writing music. It wasn't just picking, you know, parts from like Guns N' Roses or Led Zeppelin or this or that, because I also had that whole universe of international music that was stored in my brain.
What kind of age range were you at the time then, Harry, that you're talking about, when you started sort of listening to said music and playing guitar a little bit more than just strumming it for the first time and getting your head into it and wanting to join bands? How old were you around that age, around that time frame?
I would say I started playing at around 12 or 13, but I had been listening to my father's record collection from when I was 4 years old on.
Wow, okay, so really, really early days. And did you find that when you hit that sort of 12 and 13 age range, were there many kids in your area? Where are you from anyway originally, Harry? Like, what kind of town are we talking about? And were there many other kids in the area that were playing music at the same time?
I was born, raised, and still live in New York, New York City, in Queens, a suburb of New York. Well, it's technically part of New York City, part of the five boroughs. Originally, playing of the guitar happened when me and a cousin of mine wanted to be musicians. I told you I'd started with drums, where I bought a used drum kit for like $10 or $5. That lasted an entire summer, where all I could do is pick, you know, I learned how to keep time and accent on the four. One, two, three, crash, two, three, crash. And I formed a band with two other kids from my block that we wrote three original, very terrible songs, and just spent the summer playing them over and over again. Until one day I realized I can't play drums, you know. It takes a special kind of mind to be able to use both hands and both feet at the same time, and that just wasn't me. So I figured, okay, a guitar, I only have to use two hands and I can keep my feet on the floor.
Considering your age, did you go out and play any gigs at any rock clubs?
We were allowed to play one afternoon at a bar two blocks away from my house, where we did those three or four songs to a group of much older drunken alcoholics that really could care less. I do remember the name of the band, but I don't remember the musicians. It was called Hell Love, H-E-L-L-O-V-E.
Brilliant.
I have no idea why. I guess it was Hell Love or Hello V, or I don't remember why that name was chosen. It was just, you know, a young 11-year-old in New York City decided to become a musician, and that was my one and only forte in drums. And thankfully for the rest of the world, I've never sat down behind a drum kit since then.
Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, we've got a name for the podcast title now anyway, Hell Love. What about wrestling then? Let's sort of try and tie the two together. When did you find out about wrestling? Were you always a fan? Did that happen much later on? I mean, obviously we'll talk about your infamous relationship with ECW as we go on through this chat. But early on as a kid, did you watch wrestling much as a youngster?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Even before I ever picked up the guitar. Actually, my father had a guitar. He had played guitar and harmonica when he lived in Greece. He was born and raised in Greece and then came to the United States. And every so often when he wasn't home, I'd pick up his guitar and try strumming it. but had to make sure to put it back before he got home. I wasn't really allowed to touch it.
Yeah.
I actually still have that, and that was a 1957 Harmony Patrician. I still have my father's first guitar, his only guitar. But wrestling, I remember basically just changing the channels and coming across pro wrestling. And this was back in the era of WWWF when Bruno Sammartino was champion. And it was one of those things that I got very heavily into. I would watch the two WWWF broadcasts that were on, I believe, Saturdays at midnight and then Sundays at 5 p.m. Then I discovered we were getting championship wrestling from Florida Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock. And then Wednesdays, I believe at 7 o'clock, we were getting wrestling from California from the LA Auditorium, but it was dubbed in Spanish. I didn't speak Spanish, but if you turn the TV up really loud, you can hear the American commentary underneath.
Who were your favorites?
Back then, Bruno, Milton Mascaris, Dusty Rhodes, Terry Funk, Superstar Graham. Your basic, you know, old 60s and 70s legends.
Going from that then, leading up to where we are, did you ever think about, did you ever in your earlier mind think about trying to link the two aspects together? Because I suppose we weren't really introduced to music in wrestling until the sort of mid-80s, were we really, with the whole rock and wrestling evolution, if you like. I think, was it Sergeant Slaughter was the first? I can't remember now. I think it might have been Sergeant Slaughter was one of the first wrestlers to ever done music as an entrance theme with the Stars and Stripes. But when you were younger, did you ever think about tying wrestling and music together, or did that just naturally come later on in life?
It came by accidentally. I never even considered having anything to do with pro wrestling, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. It just happened. I mean, that's a story that's coming up when we get to the ECW part. But other than maybe wanting to be a wrestler for about 15 minutes, I never wanted to be part of the business, and then I ended up being hijacked or shanghaied into the business by Paul Heyman and got further into the business than I ever imagined I would.
Let's move on to the sort of early incarnations of you working with ECW then. For those of the listeners who don't know about it, how did you become aware of ECW? Did you know about them before you were linked in with them? Did you know Paul prior to? Can you talk us through the whole inception of you guys linking up?
I was friends with Paul Heyman for about 3 years and didn't know what he did for a living. Not a clue. I had stopped watching wrestling right around the time Bruno Sammartino permed his hair and became an announcer. Also, my area of New York was the last to get cable, so when the wrestling went off of broadcast television, I had no access to it. I remember Bob Backlund was champion in one of the last shows I had seen before it went off broadcast television, so I'd kind of lost track of pro wrestling at that point. The whole Hulkamania, rock and wrestling cartoon era, I did not see while it was happening. I had met Paul Heyman in a club in the 90s, early 90s. I was a nightclub promoter in Manhattan where I would be booking bands and promoting the shows and, you know, basically all of that nonsense. And I had met Paul Heyman, ironically, at the China Club, waiting online to use the bathroom. Did not know what he did for a living. Struck up a conversation. We became friends. And then the next thing I know, I'd be seeing him at the Limelight, the China Club, Spodiotis, and Danceteria and all these other clubs, and we just became really good friends. I didn't know what he did for a living. Because of the way people treated him, I figured he was either a restaurant owner, a mobster, or a pornographer. And it turns out he was a little bit of all of them. But because of the way people kissed his ass, I didn't know what a Paulie Dangerously was. I really didn't. Then, right around the time he got the Manager of the Year award from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, they were doing a party for him at a club called Octagon in Manhattan. Now, I'd gone to that night because my friends were the promoters for that. And they also had a jam session with a lot of my other friends were playing in the jam session. you know, and along with, you know, Joe Lynn Turner and this guy and that guy in the jam session and a fashion show and this and that, and the presentation of the Manager of the Year award to Paulie Dangerously. Okay, let me go see what's going on. I go to the club, I go right to the VIP room, and the first person I saw was Paul. But this time he wasn't wearing his blue jeans, leather jacket, and cowboy boots. He was in a suit. Okay, something different. He comes up. He's like, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm here for the jam session to support Matt and Steven, who are promoting the night. And there's some stupid wrestling shit going on, so I figured I'd check that out too. Flash forward about an hour later, after, you know, going through the club and hanging out downstairs and watching the jam session, I go back up to the VIP room where they've now set up one of those 5-foot-tall video screens, and they're showing clips and highlights of Paulie Dangerously.
Wow.
And I look at the screen, and there's Paulie Dangerously on the screen, and I look over to the side, and there's my friend Paul, and I look back and forth, and I sat there, and for a moment I go, oh, great. My friend is one of those freaks that dresses up like wrestlers.
You thought he was like a cosplayer kind of guy.
Exactly what I thought it for a moment. And he came over to me and he goes, so who is that handsome guy on the screen? I'm like, that's you? This is what you do for a living? And he goes, yeah, that's me. I said, all right, I won't hold it against you. I'll still be your friend.
The idea that you were in a club with him and they were showing a highlight reel and you not knowing at the time you thought it was a cosplayer. That's fantastic. That's brilliant.
That's exactly how I found out what he did for a living. Prior to that, I had no clue. And there were even other times where I'd run into him at the airport and I said, what are you doing here? He goes, I'm going to Atlanta. I said, Atlanta? What are you going to Atlanta for? And he's like, I got a parking ticket. I got to go down there and deal with it. I said, well, can't you just mail it in? He goes, nah, they're strict down there. He didn't let me know what he did for a living because, in his own words, I was the only one that treated him like a person. Because I really didn't know what he did for a living, and everybody else was kissing his ass because of what he did for a living. So I didn't treat him like a celebrity. I just treated him like a cool dude that I liked hanging out and partying with. So he ends up taking over ECW, and another friend of mine, also a fellow band member from the Slash Tones, was their sound man. And I kept getting messages through Michael Lawler, Paul has invited you to come out to the show at the arena to come out. I didn't want to go to wrestling. So I kept using the excuse that my car would never make it to Philadelphia. At the time, I had a Bronco that had like 300,000 miles on it. So it was a great excuse to say, oh, I can't make it. My car would never make it. Then I get a phone call from him. I think it's a Friday night. And he goes, Harry, I want you to come out to the show. I said, Paul, my car will never make it to Philadelphia. He goes, Harry, the show tonight is on Queens Boulevard. It's 20 minutes from your house. If your car can't go for 20 minutes, I will send you a cab. So he kind of trapped me into the corner and I said, okay, I'll go. But it's still, I wasn't into wrestling. So I said, what time's the show start? He goes, oh, it starts at 7 and it's over by 11. Okay. And I showed up at 10:45 just to show up. And that night he introduces me to Sabu and Cactus Jack, people I'd never heard of before. And I went there more to hook up with him and then we'd go grab a bite to eat afterwards. And the invitations kept coming. I went to see another show that was a Sunday afternoon. By that point, they had television in New York, so I'd watched the show a couple of times. And I realized this was not the cartoony stuff that I didn't watch in the 80s that, you know, made me cringe when I would see it here and there. And I went to a show in an afternoon in Deer Park, Long Island. And on that show, I'm trying to remember what the match was. It was the Dudleys versus a bunch of other people. But at one point, they're brawling through the crowd. And Big Dick Dudley, the late Big Dick Dudley, he slammed Primo Carnera III through a plate glass window. And that's when I realized this is not cartoony. This is real. This is dangerous. And I like it. So I started attending more shows and I was getting more and more into it. In the beginning, I thought that Taz, Perry Saturn and Pitbull 2 were the same person.
Fantastic. I mean, I'm trying to think then. So, I mean, he joined, well, it was the NWA before the infamous Shane Douglas popping the belt on the floor. angle and it became ECW. So that would have been, I think, 94, wasn't it? So I'm guessing you kind of, you joined the fray. Would that be about 95, 96, 95-ish?
95 was the first show I attended.
Yeah.
And before the end of 96, I was on board full-time in a production capacity.
Okay, so you went down the production route first, because that was the thing. I wasn't sure whether or not you were brought in straight away as a musician or whether you were more hands-on behind the scenes and what are the responsibilities you had to your name then. So, I mean, well, you've got like TV booking, obviously, through all that time. So were you touring with them as well at the time then?
I'm sorry, ask that again?
Were you touring around the US with them at the time, or were you only kind of there when they were on the east side, or when they were traveling? Because I know they weren't traveling around the entirety of the US, but they were moving around quite a lot as the years went on. They were getting further and further afield. Yeah. Did you mainly stay when it was close to home, or were you with them full time at this point?
In the beginning, it was close to home, usually the arena for the television tapings.
Yeah.
And this was still prior to doing even one note of music.
Right, okay.
I guess you'd call me a jack of all trades, where I'd be given like 100 different things to do on any given night regarding the live television tapings.
So back then as well, I suppose, there was a lot of linking with, shall we say, established music as well, music from other bands and artists. Were you part of dealing with that side of things, getting other music involved as well as what you were doing?
No, not at all. I didn't have anything to do with the music until there was the very first invasion of WWF at the Manhattan Center, when... Yep. Paul told me on a Thursday he needed original music by Monday. I had to explain to him a 3-minute song takes a lot longer than 3 minutes to record. I spent 26 straight hours in a recording studio from Saturday morning to Sunday morning to record 3 or 4 songs, clone versions, so to speak, or the Jimmy Hart versions of the songs the wrestlers were already using. Or the WWF invasion.
Right, I see.
And I didn't think it would go any further than that. I figured it was a one and done situation.
Yeah.
And I got a great bunch of guys together. I got Richie Scarlett and Steve Budgie Warner, who were both in Ace Frehley's band.
Oh, yeah.
Another dude whose name escapes me, Andy, I believe his name was. And the producer was, the co-producer engineer was Eddie Wall, who's won a whole bunch of Emmys and Grammys since then. And he produced Primer 55's first record.
Oh, yeah.
So I had a good group of people, but in a 24-hour span to record 4 or 5 songs or whatever it was, there were a lot of mistakes that I just had to let go because I didn't figure anybody would ever hear these songs again.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a short turnaround time, man. So well done for that.
It was absurd, you know, having to come up with something that sounds the way Paul described it. It's like, I need you to do songs that sound like the songs, but don't sound like the songs. And then he's like, okay, you know, like on Nitro, Diamond Dallas Page, he comes out to Nirvana, but it's not Nirvana. And I'm like, could you try explaining this in English? Yeah, I really have no idea what you're talking about. So I went to a record store at the time and I bought a whole bunch of wrestling CDs, whatever I found. Mm-hmm. I listened to them. I called Paul back. I said, dude, this music sucks. Yeah, this isn't really music. This is what you want? He goes, yes, that's what I want. It needs to sound like Kiss, but not be Kiss. Okay. So, you know, somehow or another, we came up with a clone version of Kiss, a clone version of Enter Sandman, a clone version of Alice in Chains. So I did these songs, finished Sunday morning, showed up at the Manhattan Center Monday early afternoon. They did a sound check. The songs were on DAT tapes. They weren't even burned to a CD or anything.
Wow.
And The broadcast went off. They had got what they wanted, and I figured I was done with it. And then a couple of weeks later, I get a phone call from Paul. He's like, I want you to call Taz. Taz wants to use the music that you did for the Manhattan Center.
Wow.
And I was like, well, there's a lot of mistakes. I'd have to go back into the studio and fix those mistakes if it's going to be used on a permanent basis. And I got Taz to record, first one, I Don't Need a Weapon, My Hands Are My Weapons, and a few other lines. I flew that in there, and all was well and good. And then Perry Saturn, who ran the school with Taz, he wanted his own music as well.
Yeah. Was he part of the Eliminators at the time with John?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And I went in, I came up with something for the Eliminators, and we were off to the races after that.
That all came from the back of the Manhattan Center gig, yeah.
Yeah.
So how come, out of curiosity, that Jim Johnston was doing a lot of their audio and stuff at the time? So I'm guessing it must have been a case of making it as legit as possible as an invasion, so to speak. Because, you know, there's still a lot of the underlying were they, weren't they, friends. And, you know, the storylines kind of evolved from that invasion of ECW and Paul's relationship with Vince going on from there. So the fact that they asked you to do that music's really, really interesting and puts that different slant on things. Because I think a lot of people might have just thought that it was just Jim doing some music at the time, you know?
I could see how people would think that, especially because it was on WWF programming.
Yeah.
Why they chose they needed me to do it, I can't answer the question. What I was told was that Vince did not want to use the original music that they were using. He didn't want to use Man in the Box or War Machine or Enter Sandman or I forget what the other song was, for licensing reasons.
Sure.
And they wanted it to be more of like you said, like a legit ECW invasion, where their sound was different as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense, because then it does feel legitimately like something's happening to you. Even though you're using music, it still feels like a legitimate invasion where people are coming in to whatever expect, you know, to whatever extent.
Yeah.
And it's got its own sound, and then it's highlighting, oh, what's this about? It's automatically, it's not just visual, there's an audio difference and separation from the norm there as well.
Absolutely. And then that the invasion was to build interest in the upcoming Barely Legal pay-per-view.
Yeah, that's right.
That's when the opening theme was dropped in my lap. They needed a theme song to open the pay-per-view.
Right, okay.
And, you know, he gave me a bunch of ideas, but ultimately I took inspiration from Jaws. The theme from Jaws, mm-hmm. that if you listen to the ECW theme and then listen to the theme from Jaws, you can see what influenced me.
Definitely.
You know, plus elements of White Zombie, elements of a little bit of Jimmy Page thrown in, a little bit of Nine Inch Nails. What was hip and happening at the time is what I tried to incorporate into the ECW theme. And then it just kept, you know, I kept being thrown one project after another. They mostly threw me... They're more iconic guys to do music for, like Rick Rude, Super Crazy, Tajiri, Mike Awesome, and so on. There were other people contributing music as well at that time, but it was like, I don't want to, you know, put down anybody, but it wasn't A-list talent.
Well, I'll give you an idea here, buddy, because one of the frustrations that we've got as UK fans of ECW, one of the big frustrations that we had, was that all of the music that you would play, that I'm guessing US fans possibly got on video form and obviously DVD much later, VHS form, when it came over to the UK, it was brought over by, I believe it was, Delta Video had the licensing for the UK distribution, I believe it was, but none of the music, not one piece of music was the same. It was all supermarket music, as we call it, elevator music.
Not entirely. Delta Vision did release a lot of their earlier stuff, as it was released in the United States.
Oh, did they? What was the change then? Do you know, have you got any idea about why some of it was okay and some of it wasn't?
Because they never got the rights to the music. And
right.
If Delta was located in the United States, I would have one hell of a lawsuit against them, because I know it was the ECW theme for a ridiculous number of, like, they would dub it in for Balls Mahoney, and they dubbed it in for Van Damme, and they used the ECW thing for Sabu, and they started a lot of their DVDs with the ECW theme, and I never saw a penny for it.
Now you say that, yes, the intro pages, of course, on the especially on the DVDs, the chapter selection and whatnot, that was, of course, it was the intro theme, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it wasn't until I reached out to them, you know, I wasn't looking to sue them. I was looking to see what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And basically, they told me to get better acquainted with myself, but they didn't use those words. And I was basically left in a situation where I would have to go to England to file a lawsuit.
Wow.
And I couldn't afford to do that, nor could I find a lawyer that wanted to deal with that big of an entity in England. So it was one of those things where I had to just say, oh, well, screw it.
Unbelievable. So when did you find out that it was happening?
I had gotten an issue of Power Slam magazine that was sent to guys that were putting it out. And I saw a full page ad advertising the UK DVDs. And I asked Paul, I was like, do you know anything about it? And I don't know if he was, you know, honest or not. He goes, I didn't know this existed. Why don't you look into it? So I tried looking into it. And I looked into it, and I went up against a giant corporate international brick wall. Yeah, I don't know exactly when they started being released. I know that I bought a lot of them off the internet to see what was on there. A lot of the pay-per-views that I bought did have all the music, not only my own, but like the Gangsta's music and Tommy Dreamer's music and so on and so forth. I don't know what was behind it. I know they've since stopped releasing them. Over like maybe 20 years ago, they stopped releasing stuff, but it's out there, you know, and I don't know what the circumstances behind it or anything like that. I wasn't privy to that. I know that when my lawyer started talking to them, he was basically threatened with a counter lawsuit, which I could not understand. I'm like, well, this is obviously my music and they're obviously using it. How would we get sued?
That's unbelievable. I think the DVDs, if I remember correctly, I think it must have been around the sort of turn. It must have been, I think, year 2000-ish when they were starting to come out, because I remember the VHSs running very, very late, if that makes sense. And they were doing retrospective releases. So they were bringing things out in the year 2000, but they were bringing things out like November to Remember 98. So they were getting, it was really strange how they were doing it. They weren't doing it in any kind of timeline that made sense with release dates.
Well,
it's just bizarre.
We had a deal with Pioneer Entertainment.
Yeah.
Home video and DVD in the mass market here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they ended up releasing some of those.
Right. So in terms of the relationship that you've got with ECW today then, and how it works with obviously their inventory being on the network and things like that, how is things going with yourself and that relationship?
Well, WWE purchased my catalog in the mid-2000s prior to their one-night stand pay-per-view. At that point, the catalog was dead. It wasn't like anything was happening with it. And there isn't really that much I'm allowed legally to talk about, other than all disputes were amicably resolved and they purchased the catalog.
Okay.
It would be nice to see some money from them once in a while, but, you know, I'm not allowed to talk about that either.
Okay. Zip, mouth closed. Yeah. Do you, so at the time then, we're going to rewind a little bit, and we're going to go back to when you were working behind the scenes with ECW. We're going to jump back a little bit to just before you started doing the music and you were a bit of a jack of all trades. Did that include the booking of venues and things like that? Because I know you said obviously you were doing things like booking music events. Was that a pretty similar kind of transition into the wrestling world then? How different was it?
Very little if anything to do with the booking of events, unless I was asked to like get flyers printed for an event in New York. I guess the best way to say it, I was one of Paul Heyman's 300 different assistants.
Fair enough. Because I know that some of the wrestlers themselves, they were like doing everything from designing and merching their own T-shirts and things like that as well, weren't they?
As was designing T-shirts, Tommy Dreamer and Little Guido and Devon ran the merchandising office where they'd actually be packing up the T-shirts and the videos and the promo photos and sending them to people. Bubba was booking the Elks Lodge and other New York venues. It was very much like, I don't know if you guys got the Little Rascals in England, where, hey kids, let's put on the show, and the lead actor was also the lighting guy, and you know, the guy, you know, the usher was also the sound man. And there was a lot of that going on where, you know, the wrestlers in the ring didn't just wrestle. A lot of them had two or three other jobs going on at the same time.
Sure. All hands on deck, basically.
Very much so.
So one, you mentioned merchandise there. And one of the things that we were enamored by is we couldn't believe when it came out, when we saw it, we were like, wow, as if this is a thing. Was the ECW, they were the original one, because there was two, the ECW video game that came out on PlayStation back in the 90s. Did you have much say in that when it came down to music and how it was used or what was used or any sound bites or anything like that at all?
I was a playable character in that.
With the sound and that side of things?
Nothing whatsoever. They had a guy named Rick Fox that worked for Acclaim Entertainment. Rick Fox at one point had toured with David Bowie. He was David Bowie's keyboard player for a number of years, and he did all the music for that. They ended up using the ECW theme on that game, which once again, I didn't find out about it until the game came out. One little side story about that. When I'd gone to Acclaim headquarters, they brought everybody into their headquarters in Long Island to do the facial scans and to get the sound bites. It was my voice for my character and all that. And then it came around to the moveset. Not a wrestler, but I was very familiar with the game engine, having played it when it was a WWF game.
Mm-hmm.
So for my move set, I chose all the moves that were almost impossible to counter, and I became one of the most difficult characters in the game to beat. Now, I've never done a 450 splash or anything like that in my life. I don't think I've ever stood up on a turnbuckle, but because I knew the moves and how they worked within the game engine, I chose the most difficult ones.
Well, you say you haven't done a 450, but yet is the key word in that. You know, you haven't done one yet. You never know.
That happening. If I don't see my, I never planned to be a wrestler. So at this point in my life, I'd rather keep, you know, all my fingers intact and both legs working properly. So not going to happen.
Well, they brought the second game out as well, didn't they? Which I think the second one was Anarchy Rules, wasn't it?
I was not in that game. By that point, I'd had the dispute going on with Acclaim Entertainment because they weren't supposed to use the ECW theme. So I was trying to work that out amicably, and that ended up in a lawsuit that Acclaim had gone bankrupt and filed, you know, they disappeared before the lawsuit was over, and I lost a lot of money in legal fees just trying to get paid.
Wow. Well, I know, yeah, it was like 2000, I think. Same year that the Delta over here were releasing the DVDs as well. Year 2000 was the year that game came out for Anarchy Rules.
Yeah.
Interesting.
2000 for me was the year of the lawsuit.
Yeah, it sounds like a bit of a harsh turn of the century for you there.
Yeah.
But when you started working with the company, and obviously you started making some music for key characters that you've mentioned, especially ones who were coming in, such as your Rick Rudes and whatnot, were you hanging around and hanging out with some of the guys at the time a lot more?
Yeah. I mean, I was making the music, but the music at that point was a secondary thing. I was at almost all the live events. I was at almost every pay-per-view. My work behind the scenes in production never ended when I started doing the music. And honestly, it wasn't until the ECW CD came out that some of the people in the company found out that I was doing music.
Brilliant. Were any of the other wrestlers, were any of those guys musicians in their own rights?
I know that some of them had done something here and there. I remember John Cronus told me that he had played bass at one point. I'm trying to remember. There were a few guys that at one point they played instruments. I think Justin Credible played guitar. I might be mistaken, but none of them really pursued it. It was more of like a hobby for them or something they did at one point in their lives.
Following the relationship between ECW and WWE, when they kind of joined together and WWE bought out ECW, where did you go musically from that point?
Well, musically, all right, now it's backtracking. I had stopped playing music when I received a little bit of damage to my left hand. I had broken 3 out of 4 fingers in my left hand, and it was really difficult to play a guitar with 2 fingers. It was prior to me ever being a club promoter or booking agent. I'd given up on the guitar. At one of the clubs that I was the booker at, I decided to throw myself a birthday party because all promoters in New York would exploit their birthday as if it was a religious holiday as an excuse to throw a giant party for themselves. And I decided as a joke to put a band together where I sang for the first time in my life. I couldn't sing a note. I couldn't carry a tune at the time. So I put together a comedy act where the band would play My Generation by The Who, and I would sing the words to the Beverly Hillbillies instead of the actual lyrics by The Who.
Brilliant.
And that took off unexpectedly to the point that by the third time I did a show in New York, I was playing in front of 500 or 600 people, doing nothing but song parodies and mashups. You mentioned Welcome to the Jungle earlier, Appetite for Destruction. One of the songs we would do is the band would play Welcome to the Jungle, and I would sing the lyrics to the Addams Family theme in the style of Axl Rose. And yes, I know it sounds insane. And we had a good hour and change of material like that because I would just smoke pot, watch TV, and come up with crazy ideas of how to put 2 songs together.
And Sounds great.
Yeah. And that kind of exploded on itself, but then the band itself imploded.
Right, okay.
Some of the musicians I was working with, I don't want to point the finger at anybody, you know, decided to go a little bit off the deep end emotionally, psychologically, physically, and what have you. So that band kind of came to a dead stop at one point. I had given up, you know, trying to finish an album of that material, had started not really a detective agency, more of like an investigation agency with a very crooked lawyer, which was in early 97. And then in February of 97 was when Paul asked me to do the music for the Manhattan Center. And the next thing I know, I was recording music pretty consistently for ECW. Mm-hmm. And as, you know, the years progressed, I would do more music for ECW. I tried to do the comedy band again, and unfortunately, the emotional, psychological, wackadoo issues of a couple of the band members kind of prevented me from going any further than that, and I finally gave up on it completely and was only doing the original music for ECW.
So when ECW folded, do you get in touch with old band members and other people that you knew of to kind of carry on with your music?
Well, you got to, even though I called everything Harry Slash and the Slash Tones was always who I was working with at that particular moment. A lot of mainstays, case in point, my saxophone player, Arno Hecht, who played on Sabu's music and Super Crazies and a few other songs, Rick Rude's, has been a consistent member. He's been everything I've ever done from the moment I first worked with Arno. He was the only horn player I ever wanted to work with. And if you look up the resume of Arno Hecht, it includes tours with the Rolling Stones, Robert Plant and the Honey Drippers, recording sessions with James Brown, with Tom Waits. He currently works with the legendary Dion. Arno is like an upper echelon horn player, and he's probably one of the reasons I'm still making music is just to work with him.
Yeah.
But the comedy thing, was a separate thing from the ECW thing. And then I tried to bring the two worlds together in 1998, January of 98. I did an acoustic show that was a combination of the comedy songs and the ECW songs. And one of my guitar players, who shall remain nameless, decided to show up an hour late and completely not in the same universe as the rest of us. And I decided that I was done with the comedy act. And I didn't do another live show until 2001, when I was invited to do the 25-year anniversary of Punk Magazine at CBGB's. And John Holmstrom, who had started Punk Magazine and was a big supporter of ECW, invited me to do a couple songs on the anniversary show. And he gave me a very difficult time slot where he put us on in between Thor and the Dictators. That's a tough spot. But we got over it. You know, the fans dug the ECW stuff. But when we did the Beverly Hillbillies My Generation mashup, they really liked that. And then shortly after that, ECW closed its doors. I was no longer doing music for wrestling, but I continued to do the comedy thing with variations of the band. And we did a few other shows. We did 3 years in a row, we did an appearance at the Joey Ramone Birthday Bash, which was a benefit for the Joey Ramone Lymphoma Fund. And, you know, just kept going after that. I continued to record for about a decade. I was recording tribute CDs where a record label would contact me and they'd say, give us your take on Detroit Rock City by Kiss. And I wouldn't record a straight up cover. I would add horns and keyboards and all sorts of crazy stuff. And I kind of tried to make it a Las Vegas version of Detroit Rock City. You know, I had a lot of fun recording the covers. But unfortunately, the record label decided, well, you know, we don't need to pay him. Let's violate his contract. So I stopped doing that.
Really? Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Ah, man. I've heard your version of 14 years. 14 years. I think that was on, was it on Double Talk and Jive, some kind of compilation?
Yes.
A tribute to Guns N' Roses.
Yes, it was a majority of the people I work with.
Yeah.
And Jolyn Turner, who's one of my dearest friends, who's currently living in Belarus. He moved out of the United States. He was the vocalist on that. He also sang the lead vocals on Detroit Rock City. But 14 years went out under the name Primetime Players, although it has been credited to the Slash Tones on some mediums because of the players involved was everybody I was working with at the time.
Oh, right. Okay.
In that, we tried to make the Guns N' Roses song sound a little bit like the Doors, you know, and I had fun doing that, you know, doing a campy version of You Really Got Me as a tribute to both the Kinks and Van Halen. There was a few others. My favorite, though, was we did Just a Gigolo as on a tribute for David Lee Roth, but more so we aimed it towards Louis Prima. And that was, I always like putting a little bit of humor in music. That's the Frank Zappa influence.
Absolutely. You can definitely sense that as well, listening to your music. Frank's a huge influence of mine and my bandmates as well. He's such a genius.
Yeah, he was. And so far ahead of his time.
Absolutely. And complete teetotal as well.
Yes, he was a complete straight edge. He was CM Punk before CM Punk.
You're damn right. Which is, I think it's one of those things where you see when you come across somebody with that much creativity and talent, you find it quite hard to believe, especially in the music industry.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said, could you imagine what Frank would have written if he ever smoked a joint? If he'd ever smoked a joint, I think he would have broken the laws of nature and physics within a song.
I heard a fantastic little, I know we're going off track a little bit here. I heard a fantastic little snippet about how Frank would recruit members for whatever project he was working on at the time, record musicians, and bring them in. And he would try and recruit drummers, and he'd pretty much give them a sheet of music, which some drummers would just say, I can't read that. It's just a page of black. I can't see any white on the page because there was just so much that you want me to do notation wise. And that doesn't surprise me in the slightest when you hear how incredible and how off-piste the music goes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a guy that would sit down with a piece of paper, you know, tablature paper, and write a 40-piece orchestral section. Just write it out note by note, going not across, but down the page. So he'd be writing the oboe part while he's writing the piccolo part, while he's writing the guitar part, while he's writing the violin part. He was one of the most brilliant musicians in human history. And a lot of people just don't get that.
Yeah, they really don't. They really don't. I think the people who do get it really get it. He's one of those kind of people, I think.
Band You Never Heard, the live album where he transcribed Jimmy Page's guitar solo note for note in Stairway to Heaven for a horn section. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
No, I haven't.
As a writer and arranger, just the thought of doing that influenced me a great deal. And on our version of Detroit Rock City, I took the page from Frank Zappa where I had the guitar solo played on keyboard and horns, as opposed to guitar, note for note. I had Felix Hanneman from Zebra, Arno Hecht from the Uptown Horns, and this great trumpet trombone player, Mac Gallahan, transcribed the Ace Frehley guitar solo for keyboards and horns. And that was my little nod to Frank Zappa in the middle of the Las Vegas version of Detroit Rock City, with Jolynn Turner giving me a whiskey rasp Louis Prima-esque vocal line. I love that tune.
Brilliant. I'll have to check. Is that accessible anywhere online that you know of?
I'm sure it's out there. It might be on YouTube. It was on an album called Lick It Up, a tribute to Kiss, that was put out on Versailles Records. I'm sure people could find it somewhere. I think it might be on YouTube. I might be mistaken. Maybe you can find it and dub in a little bit of it during the interview, I guess.
Absolutely. I'm sure if you could give us permission, I'm sure we'll be able to play whatever we can get a hold of.
The record label broke my contract, so screw them. And I guess you can get away with using the song in fair use because it's a podcast.
Yeah, we'll use several seconds of it. So in terms of the wrestling world, then, have you kept up with whatever's happening in the wrestling world at all since leaving ECW? Would you class yourself as somebody who's still got any kind of mild interest in wrestling? Do you keep in touch with any of the guys and girls from ECW days? And has there ever any other wrestling company ever reached out to you, or wrestlers ever reached out to you to do any music with them?
Well, as far as keeping in touch with my friends from back then, I'm still extremely tight with Rob Van Dam. I still speak to him at least 4 or 5 times a month. And whenever he comes through New York, I'll clear my calendar to spend the time while he's here. Unfortunately, a lot of my other friends, like Balls Mahoney, passed away.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Was very tight with Balls Mahoney in ECW, but he's no longer with us. I was very close to Chris Candido. He's no longer with us. I have not lost hope for Tammy. I'm hoping that things finally turn around for her.
Absolutely.
Don't know if she's, still. Well, yeah, she's in jail. But hopefully this will be the last time she's wearing orange. Mm-hmm. Paul Heyman, I'll speak to very rarely since he became a dad. The Paul Heyman, the crazy pot smoking hippie weirdo that I knew, ceased to exist the moment his first child was born. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's a very admirable thing for him. There's a few others like Sandman whenever he's in town, or Shane Douglas whenever they're around. I may not speak to them on a weekly or monthly basis, but when they're around, it's like, we pick up where we left off. Jerry Lynn as well. A majority of the people were great people. Some of them turned out to be dicks, but yeah. I didn't know at the time because I didn't really interact with them. And thanks to Facebook, I found out a lot of the people that I worked with back then were assholes. That's okay. Yeah. They have the right to be an asshole.
It's life, I suppose, isn't it? It's difficult to kind of avoid it at times, unfortunately. I know that you mentioned as well, we've had Colby Carino on the show a couple of months ago, and we were chatting to him about his stint so far in professional wrestling, and, you know, him trying to make waves, and he's doing a great job of it so far. He's, as he mentioned on the podcast, people wouldn't believe that he's been in the wrestling business since he was single figures. He was such a youngster when he had his first ever match. And then since then, he's obviously built up and built up, and he's gone and gone to the point where he's featured on WWE TV on their 205 Live product that they've got. And his dad, Steve's obviously part of the machine, so to speak, now as well.
Colby, I remember when Steve first brought him around, I think he was like 3 years old. He would get into the ring and bounce around like you knew that he had a future in the business.
Yeah, that's great.
Saw it from back then, and I've seen some of his matches on YouTube, and his father, Steve, was a great wrestler, phenomenal wrestler. Colby is going to be better than his dad. The blood, it's in his blood, it's in his genes, you know, having been raised by Steve and Jack Victory, having a part of it, and C.W. Anderson and what have you. But, you know, with Colby, he's got nowhere else to go but up.
It's incredible to see even things, you know, that around the time that we were chatting, he was promoting an event where he just finished an event where he was wrestling C.W. Anderson. Just the idea of a really amazing caliber ECW alumni wrestling the next generation of ECW blood, if you like. Just great to see. Just such a fun thing to pick up on as a fan of.
Yeah, absolutely. And Steve Corino, I think I told you offline in a conversation that I think he's one of the most intelligent guys that came through that company, because in the prime of his life, in his peak physical condition, having reinvented himself as Mr. Wrestling 3, a character that he could have kept doing into his 70s, he decided to step down while his body wasn't broken, and to be a trainer, a coach. Mm-hmm. And he's still involved in the business more so than before. But now he doesn't have to worry about getting dropped on his head.
Indeed.
The first ECW world champion to be a grandfather, and he's not even, I think he's only like 44 or 45 years old.
That's incredible. I think we were saying as well, that's something to behold, especially with that locker room. You know, yeah. Steve's the one who takes the honors for that. But no, you're right. I mean, another name that you mentioned at the very beginning there as well, Rob Van Dam. Rob Van Dam and Steve Corino are the two reasons I started watching ECW wrestling. And it's just such a cool dude, man. So I just wanted to throw that out there, because we don't get to interact with wrestlers the same way that US fans do. You know, we have to wait until a company decides to pay whatever is required to import said wrestlers over here. And it doesn't happen as often as we'd like. So we're still, whenever we see the original ECW guys getting together to put on an event, much like recently, I know that there was a get together recently in New York. I don't know who the booker was or what the event was, but it was another one of these ECW alumni getting together where the Sandman was there. Mikey Whipwreck was there. Another cool dude who's always nice to speak to from the interactions that we've had. I don't know if Jerry Lynn was there or whether he was about to go in for surgery, because he's just had surgery recently. But it seemed to be a group of guys who got together to put on another event, and there's a lot of fans over in the UK who would absolutely love that to happen over here. So hopefully one day we'll get to see something like that. Do you ever get the nod ever to say that there's something going on? Have you ever been along to any of the reunion shows in recent years? Or I suppose the last couple of decades, really.
I've been to quite a bit. When they did the Hardcore Homecoming the same weekend as ECW One Night Stand, I went to the Hardcore Homecoming, but that was about 12 years ago.
Sure.
Recently went to Impact Wrestling's television tapings here in New York. Do you guys get Impact Wrestling over there?
We do, yes, we do.
Okay, right now they have Tommy Dreamer, Rhino, Rob Van Dam, James Mitchell, Jimmy Mitchell, and Johnny Swinger. And I really, really like Impact Wrestling because they're doing something different. Rob Van Dam is a heel, a full-on hate this guy heel for the first time in his career. He's played a heel before and only gotten more over as a babyface.
Yeah.
what they're doing with Rob now, I'm enjoying, because it's something he's never really done before as far as to the degree of the character. Johnny Swinger's character is kind of like an 80s wrestler out of time, and he's playing that phenomenally. I love what Tommy's doing. Rhino is being Rhino, and Jimmy Mitchell is just phenomenal. Whenever you let Jimmy talk, I can watch him for an hour straight as the Devil character. I think he's great. So I'm really enjoying Impact Wrestling now that they got a television deal back in the United States. And I was really impressed with the way that Impact Wrestling runs their show. And the one thing that impressed me at those television tapings in Queens was the number two man in the company, Scott D'Amore, got into the ring himself and swept it out. When I saw that, I'm like, this is not something you'll ever see anywhere else, where the number two man in the company is sweeping out the ring. It just impressed me so much that it was very ECW-like, where there was nobody above the company.
Yeah.
Now, I'll occasionally watch All Elite Wrestling, which has got a big buzz here in the United States right now.
Yep.
But my favorite show to watch, I can't watch anything WWE at this point. I think I'm burnt out on them. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoy watching New Japan.
Ah, right. Okay. You're a New Japan fan.
Yeah, big time, because I'll watch a one-hour show and get 50 minutes of wrestling.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
No soap operas, no silly promos, no backstage, anything. They'll just give you 50-some-odd minutes of in-ring psychology and storytelling, like it was back in the days when Bruno Sammartino was champion.
It's amazing how much wrestling we've actually got at the moment, in terms of how much is available. And well, it's nice to see, after quite a long time of maybe, well, let's be honest, one company and a second company being what, you know, being TNA, let's be honest, at the time through the 2000s, that's pretty much all we had for a long time that was at least accessible to us, and that was that we could follow without any issues, any barriers to following it. Whereas now, there is so much that we can tune into if we want to, and it's all completely accessible. Whether it be New Japan and their New Japan World network that they've got. I know that obviously Lucha Underground were around for a while, and that kind of opened up a lot of people's eyes at the time to, wow, there's more going on at the moment. We didn't realize this. Obviously, NWA have been revived by Billy Corgan. He's doing his thing with them at the moment on YouTube, and you know, it's building on something new and fresh. Although it's got that 80s, you know, the original spin of NWA to it in terms of how they want to showcase it. It's another alternative to what else is on TV at the moment.
Right now in the United States, you have 3 hours of WWE Raw on Monday. On 2 hours, you have on Monday, 3 hours of Raw. Tuesday, you have 2 hours of Impact. On Wednesday, you have 1 hour of NWA and 2 hours of All Elite. You get a day off on Thursday, followed by 2 hours of SmackDown on Friday, an hour to 3 hours of New Japan on Saturday, and somewhere in there is the Ring of Honor television show. I believe MLW on certain markets has a television show. And I'm not sure if CMLL still has their show running. I haven't found it on any of the Spanish stations, on any of the Spanish channel networks lately. But they were going for 3 hours at one point on Saturdays. So that you've got like over 12 hours of wrestling on a weekly basis in the United States.
Yeah, that, and that's just the major players as well, you know, the ones that people would consider major players, if you like. And that's not including all of these different, you know, networks that showcase lots of indie wrestling everywhere. That's just, you know, on demand, basically.
Yes.
There's an incredible volume to watch. And we've had a massive resurgence on the back of that in the UK as well, with independent companies and wrestling promotions, the build over the last, I reckon probably the best to say over the last sort of 4 to 5 years, especially, has been monstrous. It's been absolutely huge in terms of how many good quality promotions have popped up for such a small island like the UK, where we've only ever had maybe one or two worthwhile promotions, or at least accessible, you know, bigger named promotions, that only really still stayed within the confines of the UK territory, are now pushing their way out and have become noticed to the point where WWE have obviously come over here, opened up an NXT division in the UK, have signed a lot of the talent over here down to contracts, which has unfortunately meant some of the other promotions have had to directly or indirectly close their doors because they can't now rely on those big name talents anymore to wrestle for them, which is a bit of a shame.
Some really good independent companies here in the United States. A couple of friends of mine run a company out of New York called Impact Championship Wrestling, no affiliation to Impact Wrestling. ICW, a guy named Jack Sabbath and Danny DeMonto are running that company. They're doing something different now. They're doing a show called No Holds Barred, which is chains instead of ring ropes and no DQs, no rules, kind of like a blood sport, MMA style shows. Debuting in January. I was involved with that company on and off for about a decade when they were just doing straight up sports entertainment type shows, but I honestly burned out on it.
Yeah.
You know, and I stepped away from it a few years ago. As far as you would ask me if anybody else has contacted me over the years, a huge amount of people have contacted me about doing music either for a wrestling company or for a documentary or for something like that, but nobody's ever pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. Earlier this year, I was contacted by a couple of guys that said they were affiliated with All Elite, mm-hmm. who picked my brain, asked me a bunch of questions, and nothing ever became of it.
Oh.
I am available, but I am a prostitute and I do expect to get paid and I don't do anything for free.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if like an All Elite or an NWA's got Billy Corgan, he doesn't need me. But if somebody was to contact me and had legitimate budget instead of a shoestring budget, I would consider doing music for wrestling again, but it's not on the top of my list.
In terms of just general music and yourself getting around and gigs and things, are you still pretty active in your home city these days?
Am and I'm not. I'm producing other artists. Mm-hmm. I had been working on my own album. That was a series of bad luck that has put it on the shelf. Myself and the people in the band at the moment worked on getting the songs right. It was all original material and a very big departure from anything that people have heard me do before, where this was more or less an acoustic album.
All right.
Influenced very heavily by Tom Waits, Johnny Cash, Leonard Cohen, and Frank Zappa.
Wow, a bit of an all-star kind of influencing lineup there.
So we spent a year and change in the rehearsal studio. We were about to record, and my drummer Dasso's shoulder went out, which required months and months of physical therapy. And we finally, he was ready to go. And we got into the studio and we recorded, I think, 4 or 5 drum tracks. And then there was another 6 or 7 months of scheduling issues, which prevented us from going back into the studio, where 2 out of 3 guys were available or 3 out of 4 guys would be available, but not everybody at the same time. So then everybody's ready to go back into the studio. And last year, my saxophone player Arno was rear-ended by a drunk driver doing 70 that almost crippled Arno. He was on his back for several months, unable to do anything. He had to have severe spinal surgery to keep him from being paralyzed from the waist down. Knock wood, he's good now. But as Arno Hecht was recovering from the drunk driver, even Steven, my bass player's back went out from years of damage years earlier. And he was on the shelf for several months. And he required back surgery. And just as he's getting better, my other guitar player got bitten by a black widow spider.
What?
I know, this is sounding very heavy metal, very rock and roll. Mike Lawler, my other guitar player, was he didn't even realize he was bitten by a Black Widow spider in the arm.
Jesus. Which
then made him lose a lot of the dexterity in his right hand, that he couldn't hold a pick. And he's been going through surgeries and procedures and physical therapy to get everything back from one Black Widow spider that he didn't even realize bit him.
I mean, let's be honest. You hear of really, really, really negative outcomes from bites of those very particular species of spiders. Black Widows, you know, they're deadly. So, oh, man, that's horrific. Was that in the U.S.?
Yes, it was. It was here in Queens. He also works at the Queens Theater, which is it's a theater here in Queens in Flushing Meadows Park. Uh-huh. It's a lot of acting and theater and dance troupes from all over the country. So this Black Widow could have hitched a ride on one of the vehicles coming into the theater or a piece of wardrobe or something. And he didn't realize he was bitten until he went to the doctor a few days later and his hand had swollen up like a balloon and they found the bite.
That's insane.
Oh, and if you're a guitar player, you need both hands.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, it's definitely something that's required.
So I'm very loyal to my people. Yeah. Arno Hecht is back on his feet. He's fine. He's playing. Even Steven is back on his feet. He's playing. Mike Lawler is slowly getting there. Eventually, I'm going to go into the studio and finish recording the record, but I'm not on a deadline. And there are certain people that I want to be on this album, so I'll wait until everybody's healthy.
Thankfully, you're the one who hasn't come out with any injuries from all of that, you know?
Oh, not yet. I've just gotten a little older waiting for everybody to get better.
Yeah, and stopped smoking as well.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting to see how it affects my voice. Mm-hmm. It's been three weeks today that I gave up cigarettes, and I haven't given up nicotine. I'm using little nicotine lozenges to keep myself sane and to not kill people.
Yeah.
Without the cigarettes, I have no patience, and I'm rather irritable, to say the least. Plus, I've also been dealing with lovely insomnia.
It's wonderful.
From what everybody's telling me, that this will eventually go away and I'll be able to get a good night's sleep and not hate people.
And you just find other things to become more addicted with. So I ended up just throwing myself into things such as making podcasts and putting on wrestling game events and things like that.
I'm playing more. I'm playing a lot more than before. I keep an instrument within 10 feet of me at all times. And it's been 3 weeks and I'm starting to cut back on the nicotine lozenges. Because I don't want to be using these for the rest of my life either.
Yeah.
Slow process. Eventually, I'd like to get to the point where I can smoke a little pot and not smoke a cigarette. But for the time being, I've cut that out. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm in my Frank Zappa stage, where if it wasn't for coffee, I'd be a complete straight edge.
Yeah. No, I feel that. I did it a really weird way around, where I stopped everything, including drinking. I haven't drank for about a year and a half now. But I found coffee about 2 months ago. I'd never touched a drop of coffee in my life until 2 months ago. And now I'm absolutely hooked on every variation that I can possibly find. I love it.
Well, I come from a Greek background, and I think they're the second highest consumers of coffee in Europe. It's ingrained in my DNA to wake up in the morning and have at least 2 cups of coffee before I remember how to spell my own name.
Do you have it flavored or normal or just straight?
Depends on what I have. I do like the French vanilla kind, but I'm old school, where you just give me straight up coffee, a little bit of milk, no sugar.
Yeah, sounds good to me, man.
But at least now it's just the coffee and not the coffee and 4 cigarettes before I remember how to spell my name.
What I want to do is pick your brains for a one-off. Can you think of something you'd like to share from the perspective of going on a road trip with ECW and the crew? Is there any stories that spring to mind that you think that would give the viewers a bit of a tickle if they heard this one that you're allowed to tell?
Well, I don't want to get anybody divorced.
Fair.
I'm going to say one thing, that this is something that's never mentioned, and it's something that I actually think says a lot for ECW. Nobody died while they were in ECW. Not one single drug overdose, no accidental deaths. A lot of ECW wrestlers did pass away after they left the company, but in this crazy hardcore party lifestyle company of ECW, there was not one single death. Not a one. Louis Spicoli, great guy, passed away while he was in WCW. Rick Rude in WCW. The WWE has a huge body count of people that died while under their employ, but not one person in ECW died, because while everybody was doing all their crazy shit and all their drugs and what have you, everybody looked out for each other.
Yeah.
And made sure nothing bad happened. And I would like that to be more well known for ECW's legacy, as to how much everybody cared for each other within that company. They may have not liked each other, but they cared for each other. So if somebody was getting too heavy on the somas or the oxys or the Vicodins or the Nubains or what have you, okay, he's off on his junkie binge, but we're going to make sure he doesn't die. And that's the one thing that isn't really talked about and hasn't been mentioned by anybody, that we didn't have one single fatality while they were in ECW. As far as road stories, the statute of limitations for the crimes we committed has expired. I've told this story before on the Barely Legal pay-per-view, when the security guards came out with Shane Douglas and it was Rick Rude under one of the helmets. Okay, Paul decided we needed those helmets on a Sunday. There's no stores open on Sunday in Philadelphia to go buy motorcycle helmets. So Debbie Beaumont, who had passed away a few years ago, was one of the number one people behind the scenes in ECW. Her, myself, and another guy named Haz, H-A-S-S, who was in the first ECW game as the arms master, got into a car, drove around Philadelphia, looked for motorcycles with helmets hanging off the handlebars, and literally stole them. And then spray painted them black so that we could do that spot on the pay-per-view. The first pay-per-view involved the stealing of motorcycle helmets. The last pay-per-view, we needed barbed wire at the last minute. I believe it was for Tommy Dreamer's match with C.W. Anderson. And it was too late to go to a hardware store, so we climbed up on the roof of the Hammerstein Ballroom, jumped over on the roof next door, and cut the barbed wire off a roof. So the first pay-per-view started with stealing stuff, and the last pay-per-view involved stealing stuff, and it's been over 7 years. Nobody can get arrested.
And that's a beautiful way to wrap it up, I think. I don't know what kind of message that sends out there, but I think it's definitely something that people can learn from and aspire to be at the same time.
It's something that you could not get away with today. And had the internet and TMZ been at the level it was back then, we'd all be in jail.
Yeah. Phone cameras, thankfully, weren't a thing of the time.
Yeah. Oh, if they were, a lot of people would have gotten divorced and been arrested.
Yeah. I really, really appreciate you joining us, Harry. Thank you very much for your time. Really, really appreciate all of your stories that you've shared with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. You guys popped my podcast cherry.
Wonderful stuff. And you can check out this along with so many more interviews that we've done over the years, guys, at www.bbgwrestling.com. We'll catch you soon. Cheers.
Take care.